Welcome. We're glad you've joined us for this Hand in Hand podcast. Hand in Hand is a nonprofit organization, and we provide information, classes, training, and lots of support for parents like you. We call our approach Parenting by Connection, and it's based on the insight that you deserve good support as you parent, and every child needs lots of connection in order to thrive. We offer tools to help you foster support for yourself and connection in your family. We hope this podcast gives you exactly the kind of support you're looking for.
So hello, and welcome to our teleseminar on our new book, Listen, Five Simple Tools to Meet Your Everyday Parenting Challenges. I'm Tasha Shore, trainer of hand-in-hand parenting and owner of Tasha Shore, Your Partner in Parenting. And I'm here with my amazing mentor, Patty Whitfler, who is the founder and program director at Hand in Hand Parenting. Patty, I don't know. I can't believe we're here. Let me tell you, there were some days this past year when we weren't so certain we could make this happen, I think, huh?
For sure we're.
But here we are. It's August 23rd, 2016, and I'm really excited that Listen is being launched out into the world of parenting. It's really, really exciting. So we've got lots we want to cover today, and most importantly, we want to give you the opportunity to ask questions. So there will definitely be a Q&A, in the latter part of the call. I also want to just let you know what we're going to cover today so you just have an idea of what to expect. Make sure you're really wanting to be here with us. Patty's going to start out by introducing Hand in Hand as an organization and then telling you a bit about the Parenting by Connection approach, the Hand in Hand approach and its advantages. And then I will take it over for a little bit and talk about what it's like to parent this way, how it feels to parent using these tools that we'll teach you about. And then we'll actually give you an overview of the tools, but not teach you the nitty-gritty of each of them. You can read that in the book, but rather we'll tell some stories, we'll share some anecdotes that are in the book and teach that way. And if you have questions about them, again, you can ask later on when we open up the floor for questions. And then we also want to share with you, after that, a little bit about how the book is structured. So if you haven't yet purchased it, but you're interested, you'll get a sense of whether or not it's something that might be useful for you. And then we'll go into the Q&A. So, Patty, you want to go ahead and start and talk a little bit about what Hand in Hand is and what the Hand in Hand approach is?
Sure. So I'm Patty Whitfler. I live in Palo Alto, California. I'm the mother of two boys and the grandmother of three really sweet, growing young people, all in junior high and high school now. And I bumped into the power of listening back when I was a stressed-out mom of a two-year-old and a six-month-old, and it made such a difference in my life that I just thought, oh, man, I really want to know more about this, and so sort of helped develop the ideas of how to listen to children in addition to, you know, what kind of listening parents need in order to make parenting a much more workable and fun endeavor. So that was about 43 years ago now. And I founded Hand in Hand Parenting as a nonprofit with some friends of mine who were willing to be on my board and who really liked what they saw as I put the approach out there, liked how it affected themselves and their children. And so with a small group of supporters, you know, kind of built Hand in Hand Parenting very slowly over the last 27 years. So we just started our 28th year this month, and we're here to serve parents. We're here to give parents the tools they need to deliver their love to their children and to help their children undo the stresses that cause behaviors that are difficult and that get in their children's way of enjoying life and enjoying the family. So really we're all about helping parents get the support they need and the information they need to be able to put their heads on the pillow at night going, well, it was quite a challenging day, but I know my children got their core needs met. And the main insights that we're working on at Hand in Hand Parenting are that children need to feel connected in order to function well. That connection is as vital a need as the need for water and food and sleep. And a sense of connection between parent and child really enhances children's intelligence and helps them turn out to be very capable people in the world as they grow. And, however, you know, the insight is that any little stress can interrupt that flow of intelligence and the sense of connection between parent and child. And so our book is all about the five tools that you can use to rebuild that sense of connection or to strengthen it when it seems like it falls apart pretty quickly. And when you use these tools over time, your child becomes less and less prone to upset, less and less prone to feeling like they can't do things, like they can't learn or they can't play or they can't share or they can't have any fun. They just become more their own person, and they have better and better access to the intelligence that they were born with. And so you get children who, you know, run up against obstacles, of course, because life is not, you know, not easy for any of us, but children who can really strategize to overcome those obstacles with our support until they build their own support system around them. And we've done this enough. You know, my children were, you know, sort of test cases way back when, and other children around them that I worked with back in the early years, you know, now have children of their own and are, some of them even have grandchildren, actually. But they are doing well. And so we have, you know, a lot of information from a lot of parents in different parts of the world about how this turns out long range, and the results are very good. So Hand in Hand is here to support parents getting the support they need to love their children well and getting the information they need about how children's emotions work so that their relationships with their children stay strong and positive all throughout childhood and adolescence. You know. And we're a nonprofit. I should include that.
Awesome.
Okay.
Thanks, Patty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I wanted to just talk about is how it feels to be a parent who uses this approach. Because one of the amazing benefits of using the hand-in-hand tools is that it gets us parents out of that kind of disapproving parent, I'm the bad guy role. Like, we can pretty much just let that go. You know, where most parenting approaches that are out there are based upon punishment and reward concepts, right? And most of us, when we got into parenting, that wasn't our plan. We didn't want to be a police officer. We didn't want to have to, you know, come down really hard or promise rewards in order to just get our kids to act like just normal good kids. We don't want to punish. We want to just be able to love our kids. And using the hand-in-hand tools that are grounded in these concepts that Patty just talked about, that both parents and children are good, that they both us and our kids are always doing the best that we can figure out to do in any moment. And understanding that allows us to move towards our children really with love, even when their behavior is wacky. Okay, even when they're doing something that maybe they shouldn't be doing or is what we call off track, our children are still good and we still get to love them. We just get to use our tools to help them through that sticky mess, okay? And what happens is that rather than just kind of putting a Band-Aid on the hurts or a Band-Aid on the behavior, maybe like if you give a reward or you punish a child, sometimes you will get a short-term solution to a problem, let's just say, but really you're not doing anything to heal the underlying hurts and upsets that are most likely driving those behaviors in the first place. And that's what's so awesome about these tools. And when we know we're doing that as a parent, it's like, it's just a huge relief. It's like, wow, I just get to love my child, and through loving them and setting limits and listening to their feelings and playing with them, I get to guide them to shift their behaviors. I use my love, I use my patience. And, you know, those things are important. We need to set limits. We need to listen to our children's big feelings. But because we have listening partnerships also, this is another really great thing about being a hand-in-hand parent, is that we have a tool called listening partnerships that is just for us. It helps keep us in good emotional shape. And when we are in good emotional shape, we can set limits with love. It doesn't have to be like, stop doing that right now. We can move in with a loving tone of voice. We can use loving body language, and really get a positive result. We can get that unworkable behavior to stop. So, you know, we can keep in mind that our child's behavior might be totally out of line. When we're in good emotional shape, we can keep in mind that our children's behavior might be totally out of line, but that they're still good. Like, we don't ever lose sight of that goodness. Instead, we use that behavior as a red light or a flashing light. It's like, help me, when they're hitting a sibling or when they're getting in trouble in school or when they're grabbing a toy from a friend. We start to be able to recognize those behaviors as calls for help. And as we use our listening partnerships, we can change our own behaviors and move in using the tools that we're going to talk about, special time, play listening, setting limits, stay listening. We can use those tools in loving ways to get even better results than most people will ever get using the concepts of punishment and rewards. Let's see. Anything else you wanted to add about what it's like to be a parent using this approach, Patty?
It means, I think, once you understand how important the sense of connection is to allowing a child to access their own best judgment and their intelligence, there's a cornerstone of understanding there that allows us to read our children's behavior like we read a book. And without the understanding of how important, you know, connection is, children's behavior just doesn't make sense. They say they want orange juice, you give them orange juice. They push it away like you just gave them a little glass of poison. You put it back in the refrigerator and they cry for the orange juice. And, you know, when they're 3 years old, and you just go, what in the world is the matter with my child? You know, they've just gone crackers. And with the understanding that connection is the key, you can see behavior like that and go, oh, you know, she doesn't feel connected. How can I connect? And when you do connect, if there is emotional tension that has driven a child off track, when you do connect, they will show that to you. They will have a tantrum. They will cry. They might laugh a whole bunch. They'll find a way to let off emotional tension. And if you stay with them and listen, and, you know, if it's laughter, you kind of keep encouraging the laughter for, you know, a period of time, 5-10 minutes, and when they're finished, when they don't, you know, they're not, you know, full of tantrum or full of crying or, you know, dying to laugh some more, they feel connected. It's like they got that you were there. They got that you support them. When there was emotional tension in the way before and you could stand on your head with love and they still wouldn't get it because the tension stood in the way. So there's this very important understanding that allows you to read your child's behavior and really know, you know, what will help in this situation. And you have 5 tools that you can use to relieve the tension either in you or in your child or both in order to make things go more smoothly. And over time, we just find that, you know, children's behavior difficulties dissolve. You know, they become more confident. They become more resourceful when solving problems. They ask you for help instead of banging their sibling on the head. It just smooths out the life of a parent. It takes time and it takes energy, but the rewards you get from having fewer and fewer daily flare-ups are enormous.
Thanks, Patty. And the other thing I just wanted to add, you know, I hear from parents all the time, is like, is it really this easy? And it's not that... you know, it doesn't require emotional work. It does require emotional work. But most of us are so used to moving in and trying to fix the problem all the time. You know, it's like if one child grabs from another child, we're trying to figure out, you know, who had it first and how long the other one can have it before the other one can have it back, et cetera, et cetera. We use so much psychologizing and trying to fix the situation that upset our child or quiet the feelings of upset. And when we take this approach, it's like, wow, in a way, we don't have to figure all those things out. We just have to sit back, connect, stay, listen, and our children actually know how to heal from those upsets themselves. So mostly what we're doing is getting in the way, and these tools show us how to kind of sit back and guide them on a path that they already know how to walk, essentially.
Yep.
Okay. So should we go into an overview of the tools themselves?
Sure, let's do that.
Okay. Can you just talk for a few minutes about how they're meant to be used in concert with one another? Because I think that's a really, really important concept. Because most parents come to us because there's some kind of behavior that their child is exhibiting and they're wanting to stop it. That's kind of how they come to us. But then they discover that it's actually much, much bigger and complete than that. So maybe you can kind of give a fuller picture.
Sure, sure. The tools are ways that we can interact with our children that build connection and that build a child's confidence that they are backed and that they are safe and that we care. And you don't have to use the tools night and day. It's something that you bring in and use on a regular basis for 5 or 10 minutes up to maybe an hour at a time, at various times during the day, and they work for parents of one child, and they work for parents of 8 children. We know this because one of our instructors has 8 children, one of whom is a special needs child, and she has done very, very well with these tools. So it doesn't take up all your time, but you, in order to build a good, close relationship with your child, you need to use all 5 tools. You need listening time for yourself with listening partnerships so that your stresses are handled in a way that doesn't allow them to land so often on your children. Special time is a way of connecting one-on-one with each of the children that you have and allowing the child to use their intelligence and show you what's on their mind, show you what they love, show you, you know, in play what their concerns and their issues are. And children are very revealing about what's upsetting them or what has bothered them about, you know, in their lives by constructing play around that when you give them a chance to do that with one-on-one attention. And then another proactive connecting tool is what we call play listening, which is simply harnessing the power of laughter to help people feel close to one another, help a child feel close to you, help you feel close to your child. And laughter also offloads fear. It offloads timidity. It helps children gain the confidence they need to, you know, meet challenges in their life without being bowled over for very long. Then the 2 responsive tools, the tools you use when a child shows they need you, are setting limits, which is very, very important. This is not a permissive parenting approach. And we encourage parents to set limits at the first whiff of off-track behavior, way earlier than most parents would begin to set limits. You don't want to set limits when you're already fried. You want to set limits when you notice that your child is not quite on track, and because that's a time when you're not yet upset and they're not yet dug into a really unworkable behavior. And then stay listening, which is what we follow setting limits with. And that's really staying with a child who's really upset about the limit you set or about their toy that got taken by somebody else or about the fact that they have to go to bed now. You know, whatever the upset is, you don't worry about fixing it unless there's some kind of a physical issue that needs to be taken care of. You move in, you bring the limit, you say this is what has to happen, you keep a child from doing something unworkable. And then you listen to all their feelings about how they don't like you and you're the worst parent in the world and how they, you know, their life will never be the same because their Lego piece, you know, fell down the heat register and you can't get it back. And you listen and you listen and you listen to this tragedy that has just befallen your child until they don't feel like it's a tragedy anymore. And you pour in connection. And they pour out hurt. And the more hurt they pour out, the better they feel the connection that you've poured in. So if this is a way to really, really change children's view of the world with your love and your attention, and all you do is listen. You hold the limit and you say, I know you want me to get you a different piece of toast, but this is the toast I got you, and it's still okay. And the tragedy of you not not getting them another piece of toast goes on and on and on while they release lots of feelings. And when they're finished, it's not a tragedy anymore, and they either eat the toast or they don't, but they have a really good day after they've unloaded all of those feelings that they were carrying from moment to moment. So using these tools together means sometimes you're interacting with your child and fostering laughter. Sometimes you're setting a limit. Sometimes you see they're disconnected and you think, well, I better build that connection again because we only have 3 minutes before we have to get in the car and go to the doctor's. So you do 3 minutes of special time. Your child feels more connected, and the trip out of the house and into the car to go to the doctor's goes so much better because that's the tool you used. So you've got, and you just use these tools interchangeably. But if you use any one all the time, the relationship with your child will become unbalanced. You know, oodles of special time and no setting limits is not good for any child. Too much cream, you know, on it just doesn't make a healthy child. You know, they need limits sometimes. So the tools are meant to be used together. And trying to use the tools without getting emotional support for yourself will wear you out. We've all tried that, and it doesn't work very well.
No, it doesn't work.
You too need
doesn't
need
work at all, actually.
Support. Yeah. So those are the tools and how they work together.
Okay, great. Thanks, Patty. So let's share some stories. We pulled some anecdotes from the book that we wanted to share with you that illustrate how parents just like you have used these tools to help their children and themselves through challenges in their parenting life. So, gosh, let's see. What should we start with? Should we start with a special time anecdote?
Sure, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have one anecdote in a book from from a mom who had has two school-aged girls and was struggling with kind of finding what a role for electronics. This is something that a lot of us struggle with, and there's a lot of angst in the house about how much and when to get off and what's allowed and what's not allowed, et cetera, et cetera. And she was really kind of butting heads with her daughters. And her girls kept asking for electronics during special time, and she was really, really resistant to it, but finally decided that she would try it. And when she went with it, not only were they thrilled, but she was able to really appreciate their interest a little bit, to start to let go of some of her tensions around the electronics, for small periods of time. Remember, you're doing special time. Maybe it's 5 minutes, maybe it's 15 minutes, maybe it's 20 minutes, but it's a bite-sized piece of time where she could let herself go and really kind of pour in her love and appreciation for their interest in the games or whatever it is that they were doing on the electronics. And it really shifted the mood in the house and the fighting over the electronics kind of died down a lot. You know, there just wasn't as much tension around it as there had been. And she actually said that the best thing that she did is that she started, and by the way, I want to backtrack and say, it's not that every time she did special time she allowed electronic special time, but sometimes she did, and they were thrilled with that. It doesn't have to be all the time. We get to be flexible. We can say, okay, electronic special time or a non-electronic special time if every time they're asking for electronics. But the best thing that the best idea that she said she came up with was actually letting one of the girls lose electronics while the other one got special time. So that was another way where she encouraged them to use their special time for other things. And they would get special time when the sister was getting, I'm sorry, they would get electronic time when the sister was having special time, and she would just switch off that way. So really simple to do. Resistance really was the biggest thing in this mom's way. And once she let go of that, she was really able to build some closeness with her girls. I think she said she was able to gain some street cred, I think is what she said. So a simple use of special time. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do you want to maybe share go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I'll give an illustration of the power of stay listening. One mom who was separated early from the father of her daughter, the father kind of disappeared for a couple of periods of time, for several months at a time, didn't have any contact with his daughter, and then he would come back and want to visit. and she would have him visit in her home. And their relationship was kind of, there wasn't a dependable kind of time in the relationship. And the daughter had some tension around being with her dad at first. So when her daughter was around 2 years old and the father would come over to visit, she would play with him for a little while, and then she would go running to her mom going, "I don't like Daddy. I don't want to play with him." And the mom would open her arms and listen to her daughter, and she would say, "You know, your daddy's a good man. You can go play with him. He came to see you, and he loves you. He's a good man." And her daughter would cry and cry and cry. "I don't want to look at Daddy. I don't want to see Daddy." And she would say, "Daddy's right there. You know, he's in the other room. He's waiting for you to be ready to play. He's safe. He's a good man." And she stayed listened to her daughter. And the crying would last maybe 10 minutes. And then her daughter would stop crying, run back in, play with her daddy some more. And after another 10 minutes or 15 minutes, she would start to feel disconnected again, come back to her mommy and have another cry. "I don't want to be with Daddy anymore. I don't like Daddy." And the mom, for several times when the father visited, she just listened to her daughter until her daughter finished crying, and then her daughter could go back and take advantage of her daddy being there and playing with her. And because the mom was doing special time, the dad started doing special time, and the daughter understood, okay, this is what my mommy does. I can do this with my daddy. And because the mom did play listening with her daughter, getting laughter going in play without tickling, the daughter knew how to ask and how to get, you know, games going with her daddy that would let them laugh together, and this created a stronger and stronger connection. But the real key to all of this was stay listening to her daughter's feelings of hurt. Her dad had disappeared, and so it was hard to stay connected to him because she carried this, you know, this hurt inside from those long times of no contact, and the hurt would come up. Her mom would listen to it, you know, encourage her to understand that her daddy was a good man, and here he was, ready to play with her. And over time, the hurt disappeared, and the father, who wasn't really thrilled with hearing that his daughter didn't want to be with him, could tell the mom after several months, "You know, I'm so glad that we've let her cry about this. I can see how much better connected we are now than we were before." And was very appreciative of the mom for having used the tools because they worked so well. And I think most parents in that situation would probably sympathize with their child or feel like, you know, the father must have done something wrong. And actually, there was nothing wrong in the present situation. You know, what had happened was that there had been a separation and it had been hard on the little girl. And she was crying about all of that in the past that she was still holding and was gone, and she could really enjoy her dad fully. So that's the power of stay listening. It really helps people connect and helps children gain confidence in the present situation that they can handle it.
Great. Let's see, I'll share a powerful anecdote about play listening. This was actually with one of my own boys, and it has to do with homework since we're at the start of the school year. I'm sure many of you are going to be facing homework issues soon. So one day, you know, I have three young boys, and they were much younger when this happened. And one of them came home, and he was just bugging his brothers, you know, just like nudging them, poking them, blah, blah, blah. And I fortunately was able to recognize that as a call for help and see that, okay, he really wasn't feeling connected, and he needed to connect with me, and that I knew that if I didn't heed his call, that it was going to be hard to get him to do his homework, to sit down and do his homework that I knew that he had. So I said, you know, "Hey, sweetie, you want to have a pillow fight?" And he was thrilled. And we had a pillow fight. We have a pillow fight kit that's just these really soft pillows that we decorated together as a family. They don't hurt. And we made rules, no hitting above, no throwing the pillow above your head. And the unspoken rule was that, you know, he got to win because it's play listening, and we want to allow the child to be in the more powerful role and get the laughter going. And first we started having a pillow fight, and we were throwing pillows at each other, and I was trying to figure out, you know, okay, how hard do I need to throw it so that he feels like I'm really trying, but that he, you know, doesn't feel like I'm trying to, I'm not really a good partner there, that I'm letting him get away with things, because that's not useful. And at a certain point, he suggested we do this game where he would, like, jump up and down, and I had to stand on the other side of the room and try to hit his feet, and he would, like, jump up and down. And at first, we started doing it, and he would get really upset when I would hit him. No, and he would say, like, you didn't hit me, and I'd say, I hit you. No, no, you didn't hit me. That didn't hit me. He would deny that he had been hit, and I just let it go. And then the laughter started coming, like I would hit him and he would trip and he would laugh, or I would do something silly and he would laugh. And as he started to laugh more and more, his sort of angst about getting hit with the pillow dissipated, and he would like jump and I would hit him, and he's like, oh, you got me, oh, you got me. And he could smile and admit to the fact that he had been gotten, so to speak, with the pillow. And we just laughed and had a good time, and I said, okay, you know, sweetie, I gotta finish up now. I've got some other stuff that I need to do. And he said, please, can we have one more round? So we gathered up all the pillows, and I said, sure. We did one more round. And then I said, okay, I got to go now. And he just unprompted then went to the table. We hadn't even talked about homework yet. He went to the table, pulled out his backpack, pulled his homework out, sat at the table, and did his homework like there was no big deal. And the rest of the afternoon was just really sweet. So it can really just be as simple as that. And I think what the key was here, Patty mentioned earlier when she was talking about setting limits, that we really advocate moving in early. Early and often, we say, about bringing limits. And so I could tell when he walked in the door. I mean, we can tell when we pick our kids up from school or when they walk in the door whether or not they're feeling good and connected and things are going well or not. And I saw that he wasn't and was able to move in quickly. And by using play listening, he was able to offload his stresses, whatever they were, and the rest of that evening was so well. The rest of the afternoon and evening went so well.
Yeah.
So a simple use of play listening there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll talk about setting limits. When we set limits with children, we don't stand back, put our hands on our hips, and say, do this now, you know. We see off-track behavior, and you want to move in and use your body and your connection, your sense of connection, your offer to connect. You want to use that first and say something second so that your child feels you there. You make a physical presence, and you stop the off-track behavior with your body as best you can. So, and then you listen. You follow it with listening. And sometimes children laugh a whole lot when you move in and bring a limit in that way. And sometimes they have a tantrum or cry. And you listen to that. So it's just the setting limits part is bringing the limit physically rather than expecting a child who's off track and can't think to process what you're saying from 3 feet away. In general, children, when they're off track and they're doing something that needs a limit, they can't think, and so what we say has no effect. It just so when you say the limit, you're expecting a child who can't think to think and respond, and when they don't, then you get upset, and then you can't think. So saying the limit often brings poor results because first the child isn't thinking, and then neither the child nor the parent are thinking, and then things go south really fast. We're saying move in, you know, touch your child, look your child in the eye, put your hand on the hand that's reaching for a fourth cookie, and you just go, and then wait and listen, because the less noise and fuss you make, the better chance your child has to offload the feelings that are making them, you know, starved for one cookie after the other, because no cookie satisfies, you know, an emotional need. And as you pay attention, you're satisfying an emotional need, and your child is doing what they need to do to get connected with you. So a little example, I don't know, somehow we're choosing electronics a lot here, but one example is a three-year-old who sort of loved to watch videos on her mom's phone and was watching videos, and it was dinner time, and the mom noticed that she'd been, you know, really, she was getting addicted to watching videos. It was the only thing she was choosing to do. So the mom moved in, you know, put her hand on the phone and said, no more videos, sweetie, it's dinner time. And her daughter, of course, had a tantrum. This is what children do when they are separated from the electronics that they've been connected with, because connecting with electronics disconnects them from a sense of being there with us. So that disconnection is a little hurt. And when you say no more electronics, you know, a child needs to offload that feeling of separation that they've gotten from connecting with an inanimate object for so long. So her daughter had a tantrum and cried and cried and cried. It took about 5 minutes. The mom just kept her hand on the phone and said, "I'm sorry, you know, we're going to do something else now. I think it's dinner time." And listened and listened. And after about, I think it was only 3 to 5 minutes, you know, her daughter brightened up and started jumping around the living room. And she said, I'm happy because I'm jumping. I'm happy because I'm jumping." And the mom said, you know, her little comment was, I think what she meant was, "I'm jumping because I'm happy." But her daughter was elated, connected, looking like, you know, she was so glad to be alive, hopping around the living room and very willing to come to dinner after she jumped around and showed her mom how happy she was. So setting limits means bringing the limit and then offering listening time for whatever emotional, you know, consequence there is for setting the limit. You don't have to agree with your child. You don't have to love it. But it really helps them if you can connect so that they can offload the feelings and absorb the connection with you that they need in order to function well.
Great. Okay, let's share just one more. Actually, I've got a stay listening anecdote, but I know you already talked, we already shared the stay listening anecdote, but this one also involves some listening partnership, and so I think it's just useful to show how these tools, you know, work in concert with one another. So it's actually also one of mine. I don't remember exactly from when, but when one of my boys was in about third grade, he normally would read, and I would put the others to bed, and he could just pick a book and read. And one night I said, "Okay, sweetie, you know, I'm going to put your brothers to bed. Can you pick a book and read?" And he said, I don't know how to read any of these books. They're all too hard. I don't understand anything I'm reading. I'm just going to pick something easy." And he was really, really upset. And I felt myself start to tighten up inside. Like, not because I needed to put my other kids to bed, because all of a sudden I got completely freaked out that maybe my kid didn't know how to read and there was something wrong with him and he needed, like, special help. And all of these worries just flooded my mind. And I said something about, maybe I should, you know, if you don't know how to read those books, then maybe I should talk to your teacher about it. And he got furious at me. And I realized that my tone and what I was saying was interpreting, and he was right, was sort of more like a threat. It was like, "Oh, my God, I was freaking out, and maybe something's wrong, and we need to deal with this," which wasn't what he needed in that moment. So I was able to kind of step back from that, take a deep breath, and go like, "Okay, he's just upset right now. Let me listen." And he cried and cried for about 10 minutes. I stay listened with him, and he cried and cried about how hard it was to read and how he didn't understand anything he read and he hated reading and blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden he stopped and he said, "Mom, today in school we learned about schema." And I was like, "What? A schema?" And he said, yeah, you know, if you look at the cover of the book or if you read the title, then you get kind of clues about what's happening in the book. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, this child is crazy. He's screaming and he's carrying on, and then all of a sudden he's telling about schema. But I go, okay, wow, okay, that's great. So, you know, what book do you want to read? So he said, oh, I think I'll pick this one. And he picked, you know, a book from the shelf that was his level, and he went off to read it, and I went to put his brothers to sleep, and then I came back and I said, all right, sweetie, it's time to close the book and go to bed. And then he didn't want to. He was, like, arguing to keep to keep reading. No, it's really good. I want to keep reading it. So we settled on one more chapter, and then he went to bed, and he was pleased with his book. In fact, he told me about it several times during the week after. During the week after the stay listening session, about things he liked about it and things he was learning about it. So just that 10 minutes of listening made a big difference for him. And when that was done, I felt like I was still a little bit worried, like, oh, my God, what if there is a problem with his reading? I mean, it seemed like he was doing fine now that he had that cry and that I had stay listened with him, but I wanted to be sure. So I had a listening partnership set up, and I expressed my worries to my listening partner, and, oh, my God, what if he can't read, and what if something's wrong with him, which is always, like, my big worry about my kids, what if something's wrong with them? And, you know, I cried and I worried and I shook and I sweated and I like, ah, freaked out. And then I realized, well, why don't I just ask his teacher? That seems like a reasonable thing to do. So I wrote his teacher an email and said, you know, here's what happened. And I think it's fine. He seems like he's reading fine. But I just wanted to check in and make sure you haven't noticed anything, that there's no problem. And she wrote me back a really pleasant email about how he was doing fine and, you know, that I shouldn't worry and that if I wanted to come in and talk to her, I could, et cetera, et cetera. But all of a sudden, after my listening partnership, I had regained my ability to think well. I had regained my intelligence just like my child had regained his after I was able to listen to him. And I could just think, okay, I'll ask the teacher. If there's something wrong, we'll deal with it. If there's nothing wrong, then we don't have anything to deal with. So it was pretty much a happily ever after story.
That's a great example. Yeah.
I mean, and just like remembering, I remember to this day like how I felt like at first when he said, like, I can't read it. I don't understand anything I read. When he said, I don't understand anything I read, and immediately like my insides just tightened. So it was really good. I was really glad to know I had my listening partnership to go to.
Yeah. So Tasha,
right,
do you want to talk about how the book is structured? Just really quickly, you know, what's in the book?
Yeah.
And then we can do Q&A, questions and answers.
Yeah. We only have about 20 minutes left, so I don't want to spend too much time on that because I know people are probably anxious to get their questions answered. But let's see. So let me just tell you real quickly. We've organized this book into four parts, and each part is packed with stories. There are stories from parents just like you. We've got lots of anecdotes, like the ones we just told you. In fact, we have over 130 of them in the book. They're from parents on 5 different continents. They're from all kinds of parents. We've got people of all different ethnicities and socioeconomic levels. We have just a huge variety of parents, and these tools are working for everybody. So part one we've called A New Perspective on Parenting, and it talks about really the vital work of parenting, how it's not really just a hobby, actually, even though we don't get paid, we don't get trained, we don't have support. We're supposed to just kind of do it in our spare time. It talks about the bit that I mentioned earlier, that we parents are doing our best, and that with support we can actually do even much, much better. We also discussed just the challenges, both our internal challenges of perhaps trying to do things maybe different than our parents did, as well as external challenges. We have often financial challenges, or depending on what our backgrounds are, might be targets of racism or sexism or homophobia or who knows what. There are all sorts of things that can make parenting even more difficult. And we basically just talk about how parenting is emotional work. And that connection is the key to making the relationships in your family go better. So the future is actually bright. We also do talking a little bit about the brain there, okay, and how our child's brain works to inform the tools that we use to help him or her through her struggles. So there's a lot of information, and we actually do recommend that you just read that because it's such a different perspective than most of you are probably used to hearing. It just gives us it'll give you a good background about what we're about. And then part two is called Your Powerful Parenting Toolbox, and essentially I won't go into that much because it's basically 5 chapters, one on each of the tools that we just presented to you. Part three is called Solutions to Everyday Parenting Challenges, and I like to kind of think of it as a resource for, I don't know, like overworked, underappreciated parents, like you're exhausted, you're fed up, you feel like you're at the end of your rope, and here you can kind of look up whatever struggle you're facing and see how other parents have used the hand-in-hand parenting tools to move through those struggles. So what we've done is we've kind of couched the most common parenting struggles we hear about under 4 sections: cooperation, separation, fear, and aggression. And then within those, you can look up specific issues like, okay, you're having struggles at bedtime, or if you're having struggles like with one child rejecting another parent, or something like that. And then, let's see, I was going to talk a lot more about that, but I want to have time for questions. So I think that's pretty much it. Essentially, it's like if you don't have time to read all the details and the theory, you can jump into part three, you can look up where you're struggling, you can read a little intro about what you need to know to be able to interpret the anecdotes. And then after each anecdote, there's a little commentary that we wrote that just explains why the parent chose the tools that they did and how they worked. And then the final section, part four, it starts off with kind of a few tricks of the trade, things to try when you're really at absolutely at wit's end, essentially. And then we also talk about, and I think this is really important, we talk about how isolation, guilt and blame, how not knowing how to reach for help, exhaustion, feeling confused, confusion about how to solve struggles that we face as parents, how we get worn down by this, and we don't leave you like stuck in the muck there. We just acknowledge that these are challenges for parents, and then we discuss how you can overcome those struggles by building support for yourself and for your parenting. And we talked a little bit about that in terms of listening partnerships, but we go a little bit more deeply into it there. And then at the very end, there's a sweet bit about sharing how children who have grown up being parented this way are doing, how they're functioning out in the world as young adults. And I'll give you a little tip off, which is that they're doing really, really well. So it was fun to share those stories as well. And I think that's about it, Patty. I think we can open up the floor to questions.
Okay.
Unless you have anything
if you have
a
question or a comment, you press star, what is it? You press star 2, and that lets me know that you have something you want to say, a question you want to pose, and I will call on you. Okay. So someone from San Francisco who just pressed star 2, I've opened up your line. Go ahead.
Hi, Patty.
Hi.
So my question regards aggression. I have he's almost 4.5-year-old boy, and I'm a single parent. I've been single for about 2 years now, the custodial parent. And I've been using or trying to use these tools, to the best of my ability since last summer when I took the introductory course.
Mm-hmm.
I have two listening partnerships presently. My child's being homeschooled. He struggled with encopresis for almost a year. Sure, it's functional constipation. So, pooping in the pants, having to use laxatives to keep the bowels loose, to keep regularity going, but really kind of going back and forth between using the potty and not using the potty. So I've seen behavioral changes since the development of this issue, and he was asked to leave his Montessori preschool once this issue developed. So he was only in that preschool for about 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
So the aggression, he's not aggressive towards other children. In fact, he plays very well with them. But he's primarily aggressive with me when a limit is set or during times of transition. But it's not exclusive to me. He has a lot of care from extended family, and he's also expressed himself aggressively with them as well, again, when limits are set or when transitions occur. So I really struggle with how to help him. I dip into all the booklets, like how to reach for your angry child, and try and use a special time, about 5 days out of 7 a week. But it keeps coming up. And I just don't know really how to proceed in a way that feels balanced and really balanced. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. I think the first thing I'll say is that when children are aggressive, it's always that they're scared inside. And some children have big knots of fear and that stay hidden most of the time, but as soon as a parent comes close enough to say, no, I can't let you do this, then the fear erupts and creates, fear makes us either fight or flee, and for him, it's fighting. Some children withdraw, very markedly, but he's got the fighting side of things. And how you handle that really can help a child settle in and release the fears that keep coming up over and over again. The reason the fears come up over and over again is really two. One is that the fear is probably, one that may be a little bigger than, you know, than you would assume. And the second thing is that it takes time for children to release fear. And so when they become aggressive, and we have a long chapter on helping children overcome their fears, and it's got very detailed direction as to what to do when children become aggressive. And one thing is someone needs to get in and stay with them, and at the same time protect themselves from, you know, being scratched or pinched or kicked. And so in a way, it's kind of like taming a wild animal. Your child is out of their mind and in a fear reaction. They're caught in a fear reaction, and that can be very, very healing if you stay centered and are able to say, I know this is hard. I'm right here. You know, nothing's going to hurt you. You made it. You know, you made it. You know, whatever scared you is over. I'm right here. I'm not going to go away. And you're giving that message and listening between each little piece of that message, listening for, you know, half a minute or a minute, and then saying, I'm sorry, this is so hard. And then you listen again for another minute while they are, you know, wild with upset. They're squirming and sweating and writhing, and they're all over the place. And what you're doing is creating kind of a corral around them, and the corral is loose enough to let them fight, because fear makes the mammalian body. It's like we share this with all mammals. Fear makes the mammal need to fight, want to fight, defend itself, because it fears, you know, the worst. It fears that their life will be taken. You can't talk a child out of that reaction, but you can let the reaction roll while you stay with the child, make eye contact, and reassure them that they are not in danger. And as you do that, the fear dissipates, and the signs that there's healing taking place are sweating, trembling, writhing, and a feeling of deep, deep panic. It's like oftentimes about 20 minutes into something like this, all of a sudden your child feels like they're going to die. It's like, I'm so hot, I'm so hot, I'm burning up, you have to take off my shirt. And what needs to happen at that point is that you stay steady and you stay very sure that they're not going to die. And it's like, sweetie, I'm not going to take off your shirt, but I'll blow on your tummy. I'm right here. You know, your body is hot, and that's okay. It'll cool down in a while. And then you blow on their tummy. Or, I need a drink of water. I've got to have water. And if you get up and get a drink of water, that kind of stops the healing process. And it says to the child, okay, I'm scared too. So you kind of have to, you have to guide a child through this very deep, very alarming internal experience that they're having, which is the fear that's releasing. And in order to do this, you need really good support. So you've been through a lot, and he's been through a lot. And so getting listening time for yourself and just working on those feelings as you're doing is really a good, you know, it's very, very helpful. And it doesn't necessarily relieve everything immediately. It's like we, too, have abiding fears and abiding feelings. And you're, you know, as a single mom, there's a lot that's riding on your back right now. So, but the healing process should progress over time. What, you know, you should see that the incidents of falling apart like this are happening a little farther apart, you know, week by week. They're going to be intense. It's like when children are working on fear, the intensity is strong every time they go in and feel that. But as the fear releases, it will be fewer and fewer times that they have to go in and feel that. So you look for progress in your child when that is over, and see how long can they last before they get triggered again and go back in. And if you will email me, sometimes constipation and is a sign that, you know, what's going on in their gut could be improved, and that can also help the healing process move forward. So if you will email me at patty@handinhandparenting.org. I can send you a little article about things to look for there and research. We're not the experts on gut healing, but sometimes children have persistent, you know, tendencies towards aggression that don't heal as quickly because there's another health issue going on as well that actually affects their emotional state. And I guess the third thing I'll say is if you can allow playful aggression like pillow fights or, I don't know, one of the things I used to love to do with my boys is, you know, you hop on a bed and you say, you know, I bet you can't get me off this bed, you know. And then your child gets all into, you know, kind of trying to push you off the bed. Hopefully you've got a carpet on the floor, of course. And then you can be the victim of their powerful pushing and you can climb back on and go, oh, you got me off that time. This time you'll never get me off. And they can be the victor over and over and over again playfully. And if you can get laughter going like that in the middle of vigorous play, that lightens the whole mood for a child. And laughter is a very powerful tool for lifting fear. So, you know, that's the other tool you'll want to use in conjunction with special time and setting limits. Does that help?
And listening partnership.
Yes, listening partnership that she is using. Yeah.
Yeah, I have two of those. Yeah, and so just thank you. It is very helpful. Just I wanted to know that are you feeling that or seeing in all these years that it's always effective, these tools, especially with aggressive kids that, you know, because with my child, I have to restrain him quite a bit because it's so risky, his behavior, you know, to the environment. But are you always finding there to be a dissipation, you know, when these tools are used correctly and consistently?
As long as you're working on your fears, your deep fears, as long as you're having good cries and you're having times when you also feel scared and are able to offload fear in your listening time, things will move forward. As long as there's not a medical issue that's, you know, or some kind of other health issue that's interfering. I'll just tell you a quick anecdote that one of the moms had a very severely that has trained with us had a really aggressive child who was so aggressive that she was homeschooling, meant to homeschool her children, but she had to send her younger child to school because it wasn't safe to keep him home with his older, who was the aggressive one. So this was a pretty severe case of aggression, and she just used these tools over time and kept working on her own fears. And one day, as her child was, you know, writhing and screaming and crying away, she thought to say, and this is because of the good work she'd done on herself, she thought to tell him, you know, Jordan, I'm not scared of you. Nothing you do here scares me. And she said she felt their whole relationship change as soon as she could say that, and it took her, I don't know, 6 months of working on herself to become unscared enough to handle him without feeling, you know, tense through the whole thing. And as soon as she got there and could say that to him, everything changed. And he still has to work on his fears, but she's not scared any longer, and he's not scared of himself. You know, he's not getting fear. The fear inside of him isn't being triggered by her fears anymore. And it made a huge difference. So I don't know if that gives you a picture of, you know, sometimes it's us that have to move through stuff before our children can truly feel safe.
Thank you.
The work is important on both ends. And we have consultants. So if you want some help with, you know, your end of things, with working on your end of things, or just people to talk to once a month. We have really good parents who've helped their kids through all kinds of stuff. So,
thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. We might have time for one more. And someone from, let's see, San Francisco, and the last four digits of your phone are 0778. I'm going to open
that's
your
me.
Line. Uh-huh. Hi. What's your
Hello?
Name?
Michelle Bazergan, sorry.
Hi, Michelle. Yeah.
Hi. So I heard about Hand in Hand Parenting in San Francisco at a mom and me support group.
Mm-hmm.
And then have been trying to work with it for, I guess, 4 years, since my son's 4 years old. We recently moved to Boston, and so with along with the big changes and everything, I've decided for myself that we need to sleep separately, aside from the family bed. So we waited about a month. We tried to do it when we first got here and decided it wasn't really working because our son would just come back into our bed. So my challenge right now is we've given it a month and I've talked with my son about it and I'm able to listen to him during the first part of the night. But the wake-ups that happen, like, at midnight, 2 a.m., and then 5 a.m., and then 6 a.m., are challenging to listen to. I want to listen and be there for him, but it's the middle of the night. More like the 5 a.m. one. I'm like, you know, like, I can prepare for the first part of it by doing play listening earlier or... and again, like trying to have special time earlier and maybe wrestling even before just to get the energy off. But, yeah, my challenges are at like the 2 a.m. and 5 a.m.
Tasha, do you want to take this one?
Sure. I guess my first question I was going to ask is, are you able to get listening partnership support for yourself?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. So one thing I always say, I always ask parents when they're wanting to move a child into their own bed is, are you really ready? Because some people aren't really sure that this is what they want to do. So first I want to make sure, okay, this is you're on board and you really want to do this.
Yes, this is our third try, so yeah. I want to try this.
There are several things you can do. It sounds like you're doing some of them. Play listening is a great thing to do before bed.
Right.
So really, like, physical play. The contrary to what most people believe, like, we talk about winding down and quieting kids and whatnot, actually that sense of feeling really connected to a loving adult before they go to bed helps them sleep better. And for most kids, or for many kids, I should say, fears tend to come up in the night, so there are a lot of kids who do wake in the night. So play listening is a great thing to do to start, and do it, you know, vigorously and, you know, full on, not to fear that you're going to ruin their night's sleep, not to hold back. So
yeah, we do heavy
like
wrestling, wrestle. So, yeah.
Great. So that's good. So play listening is a good thing to do. And then stay listening. I often tell parents that who are trying to work with sleep issues that it doesn't have to be that you're only stay listening in the night. Sometimes because it's so exhausting to listen so many times during the night, if you can take a couple days to kind of scan his days and the times that you're with him and notice what his triggers are, and if there are times when you can move in close, maybe you'll need to set a limit. Maybe it's just something that's a trigger for him. It's a transition or whatever it is that feelings come up for him, and you can move in close and listen. Those times that you're able to help him offload during the days will also carry over into the night. Okay, so that that's something that people sometimes don't think of. It's all connected. It's all connected. So that would be one thing I would try. What else? Oh, and the other thing I was going to say is, you know, this is what we call an emotional project, which is kind of like not just a one-time issue, but something that's ongoing that you're wanting to deal with. And so you might think creatively about how to do your nights. I don't know if you have a partner or if you have a friend who could come spend the night with you, a family member maybe, either maybe somebody else who, it doesn't have to be only you who listens, okay? Or maybe somebody could come over sometime during the day or on a weekend where you can get some extra rest during the day. So my message is you don't have to do it on your own. You can enlist other people. You know, if you can sit down and think like, okay, where do I really need a hand here? You know, where am I really breaking down? I suggest reaching out for help. It makes a huge, huge difference. So I think it sounds like other than that, you're on the right path. It will work. It's just, you know, a lot of fear. It's just a lot of fear, and the more you can listen, the more he'll offload. And I guess one other thing that I want to say about sleep is that it's okay to not carry it all the way through each night. So in other words, you're tired, but, you know, you're able to stay listen the first couple times he wakes up, and by the third time you're just dead. It's okay to go into his room and say, you know, sweetie, you've worked really hard tonight. We're going to pick up on this tomorrow, and get in bed with him and go to sleep. You haven't lost the work you've done prior.
So, and, yeah, because that's my part. So I can stop, like, at
yeah, it's not
5 a.m. or, like, let him come into our bed. Even?
Yes, you can.
And
that's been my experience, because it's not useful. I'm sorry I interrupted you, but we're short on time, so I'm going to interrupt you. it's not useful. We're not really helping our children heal when we're not at our best, right? Or at least doing pretty well. So if you're exhausted and frustrated and short on patience and annoyed, you're not going to be able to stay listen to him effectively. So it's better to first come back and regroup.
So I was trying to do the thing where, like, good night, my love, time for bed, the next time for bed, the next time we're not saying anything, and I'm just going in and letting him cry. Like, I tried that for a bit, but I didn't need to get there, but it just went so against what we do in with the listening that
I think I didn't exactly follow what you said. Say that again? I didn't quite follow what you're doing.
So it would almost be like cry it out a little bit, right, where you tell him the first time, good night, it's time to go to bed, you know, I love you. Then the next time it's time to go to bed. And then the next time you're not saying anything. And then, but you walk out of the room and you let them cry. And it just, I'm like, how do I listen to him from another room? How do I let him know I'm here? And supporting him.
So let me clarify. He's not crying it out. You're
exactly.
not leaving him on his own.
Exactly.
You're staying with him, and the healing happens when he's able to show his fears with your loving presence.
Right.
Okay, not when you're, you know, off in some other room and he's screaming and you're crying because you can't stand to listen to it because your heart's breaking. This is not what we're talking about.
Right. Because throughout the day, I'm listening to him and stay listening and, like, really present with him and just trying to just, like, be there with him and hear him, like a listening partner might do for me, like I need. And then, but, hi, Bubba. Sorry. So,
that's okay.
But I'm trying to do that, but to not do it consistently throughout the night didn't feel right, so I appreciate this clarification.
Yeah, actually,
I don't think you need to be as consistent as you need to be, and in the interest of time, I'm going to have to end here and say what Patty said, which is that we have lots of instructors you know, who have helped parents help their children sleep through the night. It's something that many of us deal with all the time. So if you find that you want more help, please reach out. But it sounds to me like you're on the right track.
Thank you.
And there are things that you can say to him while he's crying that will make a huge difference. It's like being silent while a child cries their heart out is not, you know, not the best thing. And the book lists several kinds of things to tell him while he's crying that add to the reassurance of your presence. So,
thank you.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, we want to thank all of you for joining us for this teleseminar. And you can, Tasha, do you have last words you want to say?
No, I don't. I'm just, you know, just thank you for taking the time out of your busy day and prioritizing connection in your family. And one thing that I do want to say is that if and when you do read the book, I know I can speak for myself, and I think I can probably speak for Patty in saying that we would love to hear what your impressions are. If you have successes, what they are, please don't hesitate to share that information with us. It's really, you know, we're here for you. We wrote this book for you guys, and we'd love to hear how you're doing with it all.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't know already, you can get the book at handinhandparenting.org. That's our website. And you will also find there over 100 articles on all kinds of things like toileting and sleep and sharing and sibling relationships and all kinds of
fear and aggression.
Yep. And we have parent consultants who are absolutely superb at helping parents understand how to use these tools and shepherding them along week to week or month to month. There are classes online that you can take in which you'll be mentored by an experienced instructor who really loves to support parents in their understanding of these tools and really getting their families connected and enjoyable again. And there are blog posts. We've got all kinds of information and resources online. So, and you can also get the book at Amazon.com. So thank you so much for being with us, and we sure hope that what we've written down will aid you in your love, delivering your love to your child, and in having a connected and rewarding, you know, chance to parent them with love and connection. So thanks a lot, Tasha. Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you, Patty.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us. Hand in Hand is here to help you get the support you need for your work as a parent. To download podcasts on additional parenting topics, go to handinhandparenting.org/store. We look forward to connecting with you again soon.